Tax Update for Saturday, March 10th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, March 10th, 2007. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of this document or the audio file podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, we took a week off last week of doing the tax update, and now we're back looking at a new case that came down this week that gives a little pause to taxpayers who believe the way one selects a tax professional is to opinion shop and find out who gets you the lowest tax or the highest refund. And this week we take a look at the case of Allen versus Commissioner, 128 Tax Court Number 4, a published tax court decision that dealt with the interesting issue of whether the statute of limitations for a fraudulent tax return could be extended merely because the taxpayer's preparer was involved in preparing a fraudulent return for the taxpayer, even if the taxpayer himself basically was unaware or didn't actively participate in providing fraudulent information. Now, the tax court this week had to decide that issue because we had a case, as noted, where a taxpayer had been assessed their tax for a return that had been prepared by a tax preparer who had essentially invented deductions. And the IRS was assessing after the 3-year standard statute of limitations had expired. Now, we'll see. Can the taxpayer get away with it in that case? Do you just get lucky? And is the goal of this game to find the tax preparer who gives you the lowest, tax, highest refund, and then hope 3 years pass and be actively ignorant? Well, to look at this, we have to look at the basic first statute that we have to worry about for when the IRS can assess tax. Now, remember, the general rule we have here is there is, in Section 6501, a rule for how long the IRS has to assess tax against a taxpayer. Now, a statute's basically required in a case like this because otherwise taxpayers would be required to forever maintain the records. If the IRS could go back and go after every single tax return you ever filed forever, you'd have to maintain records on exactly what you had been doing in 1978. That probably doesn't exist for many taxpayers, and it'd be very difficult to have those voluminous records following us around everywhere we go for the whole of our life. So the statute provides that in most cases we're going to have a standard statute of 3 years. The rule is found in Section 6501A, which provides the initial clause says, except as otherwise provided in this section. The amount of any tax imposed by this title shall be assessed within 3 years after the return was filed, and goes on this, or if the tax is payable by stamp, we have various other little options here. So basically, we have the general rule says that we're going to get 3 year statute unless there is another exception found in Section 6501. So the IRS has 3 years from the date of filing the return. Now, one of the key exceptions we're going to talk about today, the one that is at issue in this case in question, is found in Section 6501C1. That deals with false returns. And that term, obviously, any return that has an error is arguably false, so the term is defined a little bit more narrowly than just that. And it tells us in the case of a false or fraudulent return with the intent to evade tax, key clause there, the tax may be assessed or a proceeding in court for collection of such tax may be begun without assessment at any time. So if we have a tax return that is a false or fraudulent return with the intent to evade tax, so the return must be false or fraudulent, and there must have been an intent to evade tax, the statute stays open forever. Well, that's quite a bit longer than 3 years, as you might guess, and is a real major problem if a taxpayer is exposed to a fraudulent tax return. Obviously, the point there is not to let taxpayers play hide-and-seek by doing fraudulent returns and then play the audit lottery, presuming that, oh, when 3 years are up, tough luck, IRS, I just had to hide from you for 3 years, and once that's over, I get to get away with this issue, so just forget it. Now, note, this is not an issue where the IRS needs to show criminal intent or that, you know, a criminal fraud. That's a different set of issues. This merely is the civil issue of when the IRS can assess and go after the tax in question. Now, in this particular case, we're looking at the question of, well, does this statute and does this provision imply that the intent to evade tax must have been the taxpayer who filed the return? That was the key issue we were looking at in today's case. Why is that important? Because if that's the case, then I've got then being an actively, or not say actively, let's say, but at least an ignorant taxpayer who just had no clue that their preparer was doing things that were improper, could get out of the statute. The IRS, remember, needs to show that there was a false or fraudulent return, because the general rule is, if there wasn't such a return, we have a 3-year statute. So if the taxpayer claims ignorance, now the problem is trying to prove the taxpayer was not as stupid as they claimed to be, and really, really, really did believe that those were legitimate items on the return, and they had no intent to evade tax, that was just the intent of the preparer. That would also allow preparers, essentially, to play the same game and hide behind it, since now they would be looking at the sanctions, but again, the tax couldn't be imposed, so the civil rules or the civil problems against them from the taxpayer for having prepared this return where the taxpayer now had to come up and pay the taxes and interest and penalty no longer is a worry, because the 3-year statute is over, the IRS can't collect the above, and hey, it wasn't my tax return, so I don't owe it. Therefore, it seems like everybody could get off scot-free. Does that work? Well, let's take a look at the Allen case. In the Allen case, we have a UPS truck driver who engaged the services of a tax preparer who apparently was a frustrated novelist and decided to turn his preference for writing fiction to the tax arena. And Mr. Allen gave this preparer a W-2, a 401k statement, mortgage interest statements, and something the tax court referred to as property statements. I would presume they mean property tax statements of some sort, for the years in question, 1999 and 2000, which were the 2 years in question in this case. But as we note, a good novelist never stops just with the facts they know when they do their research. You know, you've got to expand that and go beyond. So the preparer in question did not limit himself to just that information. From that information, he also claimed additional false and fraudulent deductions on Schedule A per the tax court. They included charitable contributions, meals and entertainment, pager and computer expenses, and various other expenses. Those items were put on Mr. Allen's return. Now, Mr. Allen, according to the court, received complete copies of those returned for the years it issues, but after they had been filed. Now, what that may mean, and we don't know for sure, the court doesn't mention it, but it's very possible that our novelist tax preparer may very well have signed that little detail about you don't e-file the return until the taxpayer has reviewed the return, signed the authorization, hand it back to you. He may have shortcut that provision a little bit too. So the returns, at least 1999, obviously was a done deal by the time that Mr. Allen got it in his hand and had it available for review. Now, the court notes that he did not amend either year in question. But at least for 1999, we can argue that Mr. Allen, it was a done deal by the time he was handed the return. The return had been filed. There were fraudulent deductions claimed. Let's assume Mr. Allen had noticed that. Even if Mr. Allen had noticed it, I doubt that our novelist tax preparer was going to spend a lot of time informing Mr. Allen that, oh yeah, I did a fraudulent return, and oh yeah, you have the right, and I'm going to notify you under Circular 230 that you probably should amend this return. Nevertheless, the tax court did specifically note in reciting the facts that Mr. Allen did not prepare an amended return for either year. It's probably also not a good thing that Mr. Allen, after getting the 1999 return, which although the court does not say, we will presume was before the 2000 return was prepared, didn't turn around and say, oops, you know what, he really did something wrong, and even if I don't know about amending or don't know any other things, I really shouldn't take my next year's return back to him. Obviously, he took the 2000 return to him, and again, the same process was followed. Now, unfortunately, the IRS Criminal Investigation Division doesn't have a lot of sympathy for tax preparers who are frustrated novelists, and the IRS CID Division ended up visiting the taxpayer in this question and discussing with him the work of his preparer, as well as visiting the preparer. Now, according to the tax court, they note that two agents of the CID interviewed Mr. Allen concerning his preparation of the return. And eventually, the preparer was indicted, tried, and convicted on 30 violations of willfully assisting in preparing in false and fraudulent income tax returns in 2006. The court did note, however, that Mr. Allen's returns were not the ones specifically involved in those 30 counts. In essence, Mr. Allen's return was not used as one of the counts to send the tax preparer to jail. So the tax preparer, and we shouldn't say to jail, we don't know what the sentence was, but nevertheless, it appears the preparer certainly had a little problem here with a criminal conviction in 2006. So that part of the saga is over, and obviously Mr. Allen now needs to find a new preparer. Usually it's not a good thing once you find out your preparer has been convicted. That probably eliminates any ability to rely upon their work. So we'll leave on. Mr. Allen's going forward, but Mr. Allen, it turns out, on March 22nd of 2005, the IRS got around to sending a notice to Mr. Allen about the tax returns that his preparer had given him. And the specific problem we get into was they issued a notice on March 22nd of 2005. Now, March 22nd, 2005, let's think about that versus the statute of limitations. A 2001 tax return or a 2000 tax return had been timely filed by April 15th of 2001 would have had its statute closed on April the 15th of 2004, well before March 22nd of 2005 when the IRS issued the notice. Now, the IRS notices in question covered 1999 and 2000. We do not know from the facts in this case, but it's very possible they covered later years. Obviously, those years would not be at issue with the question of the statute of limitations. Those statutes would have been open on March 22nd, 2005. But we are concerned now about the 1999 and 2000 returns because if, in fact, the general rule we had discussed for Section 6501A applies, those returns are now closed and done, and the IRS cannot assess. The IRS claims, oh no, those were fraudulent returns under Section 6501C, and therefore, we have the right to assess the tax at any time, so the mere fact 3 years have passed since the due date of the filing of the returns is irrelevant. We can now go after the tax. So we take a look now of having to decide, are these returns the false and fraudulent returns of the type described in Section 6501C1? Now, the IRS says, clearly the returns themselves are fraudulent. They contain deductions that were placed on the return with the intent of evading income tax. Now, that intent may have existed with the tax preparer, who, from a marketing standpoint, is able to attract a wider client base by saying, oh, I get you a much bigger refund than the guy down the street who is preparing your return, so why don't you come in here and let me do it? I mean, it's a wonderful marketing position, having money flow at clients is always, kind of a positive in terms of bribing them to come in. So he may have really, obviously there was an intent there, evading the tax. He was using the U.S. Treasury as a way of bolstering his business by having them pay his customer base, and then he goes ahead and collects his fee. But the issue was, is that enough to show the returns are false and fraudulent? Now, the case did boil down to this as an issue of law because prior to trial, the IRS and the taxpayer agreed specifically to a couple of points. They agreed, both parties did, that the taxpayer, Mr. Allen, did not himself have the intent to evade tax. Both parties also agreed that his preparer, who claimed the false deductions in the years in question, did specifically have the intent of evading tax on those returns. So we now have basically stipulated the facts are taxpayer is innocent, tax preparer is guilty of, fraudulently handling returns. In that fact pattern, are the returns themselves tainted under Section 6501C1? The tax court now analyzes the law in question. Under the law in question, the tax court notes that the taxpayer's position was that the general rule of 6501A is what applies, and that the IRS simply is too late. The court notes that the taxpayer alleges its limitation period for assessment of taxes with respect to their returns for the year at issue expired before the IRS issued the notice. Therefore, the taxpayer says that the preparer's fraudulent intent to evade tax is not sufficient. The IRS says, whoa, the preparer's intent is sufficient to keep the period open. And the taxpayer said, no, it requires that the taxpayer and not the preparer be the one who had the intent to evade tax in order for 6501C1 to apply to the return, because obviously it applies to the taxpayer's return. The tax court considered this argument, but notes that it found nothing in the plain language of the statute that limits Section 6501C1 in the way that the taxpayer is arguing. The court notes that the statute provides a tax may be assessed at any time in the case of a false or fraudulent return with the intent to evade tax. Notably, absent from this provision is any express requirement that the fraud be the taxpayer's. The court goes on to note that nothing in the plain meaning of the statute suggests limitation appeared extended only in the case of the taxpayer's fraud. The statute keys the extension to the fraudulent nature of the return, not to the identity of the perpetrator of the fraud. Nor will the court, as it goes on, read the words of the taxpayer into the statute, kind of adding it in as an implied phrase, to require the taxpayer to have the intent to evade his or her own tax. So the court is saying, we don't accept their theory that it has to be the taxpayer who had the bad faith. The bad faith by the preparer is good enough to taint the return. Now, to counter maybe the concept that this seems unfair, it goes on and explains why this makes sense. It looks at the IRS arguments, and it says that the IRS notes and that the court agrees the statutes are strictly construed in favor of the government. An extended limitation period is warranted in the case of a false or fraudulent return because of the special disadvantage to the commissioner in investigating these types of return. 3 years may not be sufficient for the commissioner to investigate or prove fraudulent intent. And goes on to state that we agree with the respondent that the special disadvantage to the commissioner in investigating fraudulent returns is present if the income tax return preparer committed the fraud that caused the taxes on the return to be understated. Accordingly, taking into account our obligation to construe statute's limitations strictly in favor of the government, we conclude the limitations period for assessing the petitioner's taxes is extended if the taxes were understated due to the fraud of the preparer. Now, the taxpayer goes on to argue, but our burden is too strong if that happens. Because, look, it means taxpayers would have to keep their records open forever due to the possibility that the IRS might argue that their preparer is the one who committed the fraud. And with a fraudulent intent on part of the preparer, the taxpayer's returns could be open forever. So unless I know for sure that my preparer did not make a fraudulent return, I'm stuck with having to maintain my records forever. Unfortunately, the court did not have sympathy for this argument. It says specifically that taxpayers are charged with knowledge and awareness and responsibility for their tax returns, and the taxpayer and not the preparer has the ultimate responsibility to file his or her tax return and pay the taxes due. You cannot avoid your obligations under the law by relying on an agent. The court specifically notes we do not find it unduly burdensome for taxpayers to review the returns for items that are obviously false or incorrect. It is every taxpayer's obligation. The taxpayer cannot hide behind an agent's fraudulent preparation of his returns and escape paying tax if the government is unable to investigate fully the fraud within the limitation periods. Goes on to note that the government has just as much a need for an extended limitation period to investigate and examine taxpayers who sign and allow returns to be filed that greatly overstate expenses or include fictitious expenses, whether the fraud was committed by the taxpayer or taxpayer's preparer. To find otherwise would allow a taxpayer to receive the benefit of a fraudulent return by hiding behind the preparer. Taxpayers whose returns are fraudulent owing to fraud committed by preparers would escape their tax liability if the commission were unable to identify or investigate the fraud within the normal 3-year period. The issue seems to be in the court's opinion that the taxpayer has the obligation to review the return, and if it appears wrong, the taxpayer needs to stop the process. They cannot become actively ignorant. Now, the case does beg the question of, does that mean that the fraud provision would only apply if the return prepared by the preparer had a fraud that was of a nature that it would be reasonable the taxpayer should have noticed the problem? In this case, it appears fairly obvious. You know, if you're inventing expenses for a computer or a cell phone you never had or never told the preparer about, it would certainly seem that a reasonable person might expect that's not something that should have been allowed on their tax return to begin with. So therefore, under that theory, it seems to make sense that a taxpayer would need to review that return and would be somewhat at least responsible for not having noticed it. What begs the question in this case is, what if in fact the fraud was such that the taxpayer was not aware the return was fraudulent? For instance, let us assume that the taxpayer was sold a, in the marketed tax shelters days, one of the key allegations that we've heard in some of the criminal cases that came down were that transactions never took place that were supposed to take place under the shelter. That in fact, you know, regardless of the question whether the shelter worked or not, if the transactions were executed, that in reality the claim the government has made in some of the criminal cases were that parties were aware the transactions were never executed. In that case, arguably, it's not reasonable for the taxpayer to have known that that transaction never took place. But let us presume their preparer did know, that in fact the preparer had sold them a package and sold them a deal, but in fact the transactions for this tax shelter never took place. Therefore, obviously, reporting transactions never happened is fraud, the preparer was aware of it. Would that open the statute under this ruling? Under this ruling, we're not sure, because if you read basically the dicta here of what the court is saying to justify their position in the end, it would seem there's a sympathy here for taxpayers who could not have known about the fraudulent issue. But if you take the literal ruling in this case, it seems to say that the mere fraudulent intent of the preparer would be good enough, and even in that case, the taxpayer may be stuck with an extended statute of limitations. We don't know under these rules. Now let's consider then at the end now, what are the overall conclusions of this case? Well, I think it's an important case for all of us who are in tax practice to know and have available to us when our clients come to us and tell us about what they do from time to time, that Joe down the street, his preparer has put X on the return for years or claimed Y on the return for years, and it's never been challenged, never been audited, there's no problem, so you know, why the heck can't I do it? And one of the answers to that is, well, you know, that's simply not allowed, and many times these are positions that clearly are unallowable under the code. Or even the taxpayer says, you know, they'll even say, well, the preparer, you know, well, we, you know, he just says you get to take X dollars worth of medical expense regardless of whether you pay it. And that clearly is not allowed. And you now at least have an explanation to say, you know what, that the problem is that's clearly against the law. And number two, here's a case that says if you in fact use a preparer who does that, you're exposed to them coming back for the tax forever rather than just a 3-year period if you use a preparer who puts the return within the scope of the law and there is no fraud being committed by the preparer. Secondly, it's an issue when we get new clients now who have problems. And as I briefly discussed, it may even be an issue if you have a client who participated in a transactions where there are now allegations that the tax shelter transactions never took place, and that may have happened without the taxpayer's knowledge, but the government is arguing with the tax preparer's knowledge. And in that case, we have an issue and a potential problem of how do you advise taxpayers? They may need to be aware the statute may be extended. Now, this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, March 10th, 2007. Tax Update Podcast is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. You can visit them there and take a look at their tax materials for information for use for tax preparers and tax professionals in their tax work. This has been the Tax Update.